G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather
Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yeah. Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. It's very nice to be back in front of you, John. We are the required distance apart, though.
Yes, we are. How are you, Ashley?
I'm good. Well, I'm Ashley Morrison, and we've got a great show lined up for you again today.
I'm John Lee, and I'm looking forward to sitting here and talking sport with you, Ashley.
Absolutely. Well, our special guest on this show, we're going down a different path because skateboarding has become really popular. If you know, it was going to be a part of the Olympic Games this year, but it's obviously been pushed back now to next year. And when I was at the Southeast Asian Games and the Asian Games, I actually ended up commentating the skateboarding on both occasions, which was a challenge for me because I was useless at it and I didn't know any of the terminology, but I had to learn some of it anyway.
I would have thought you'd been right up with the ollie.
Yeah, I know that one after the Darren Harper on Challenge
That's
Ash.
Going back a long
it's
time.
It's a long, long time ago. But our guest on this show is Marielle Flood, and she is actually somebody who's now being commissioned to customize the artwork on skateboards. Now, some of them, as you'll hear in the interview, are for purchase, and some of them, some of the skateboarders actually want to use and compete with, and she's got very involved with the music scene there and has done some for some musicians as well who've bought the boards off her. So slightly different tack, but I think you'll find it very interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, actually.
That should be good.
But what are we starting with?
Shall I start?
Go on.
All right. I don't know. As we were getting ready to record, I heard that they're talking about with cricket now as a result of the COVID-19 that they're going to stop bowlers being allowed to use their saliva to shine the ball. And I understand, obviously, we've got issues at this point in time, but I'm going, well, okay, how is a player then going to shine the ball? You're going to have to rewrite the laws of cricket because you can't use saliva. So are you going to be able to use grease, or are you going to be able to use sandpaper to scuff up the other side? How are you going to get a shine on the ball? Because presumably you wouldn't be allowed to use your sweat either.
Well, my first port of call would be the old Dennis Lilly eyebrow, forehead wipe with the ball. But yeah, as you mentioned, obviously that's not going to be in. I'm staggered by this, I must admit. Obviously, a saliva-licked ball is not going to be in any way danger to the batsman. Because the batsman...
You wouldn't have thought so.
You know,
unless he's going to take a bite out of it.
Exactly. The batsman tend not to touch the ball with their mouths or noses, or and even their hands are gloved.
Yep, and they're not allowed to do that anyway.
Yeah, that's right. It just, and is it to protect the teammates?
Well, it could be the fielders, I suppose. If the ball goes straight past the batsman into the keeper's gloves and they throw it at first slip, he could be touching that saliva.
Yeah. I mean, the saliva's going to stay on there in some way, shape or form, just because the ball bounces or it gets hit doesn't mean the saliva comes off. But these guys are all in a change room together. They share showers. They share hotel rooms. They share eating facilities. If the disease is going to be spread amongst a cricket team, I would think that it's not going to be from someone licking a ball.
Well, that was my view as well. I thought it was a real knee-jerk reaction. And I just find it strange. I mean, we seem to be wanting to change everything. Now, I'm sure that the world is going to be slightly different when we come out the other side of this. But seriously, I mean, that just seemed to me... There's no proof that you can catch it from that. I mean, and also, you know, how many bowlers, the top bowlers... Yes, they hit the seam, so that side of the ball may probably not. But a lot of other bowlers do not hit the seam, and it will hit the ground before it gets through to someone being touched on the hand.
And what's the one thing we have been told since the beginning of this whole episode that kills this virus? Sunlight. And I'm pretty sure that all cricket games experience, except maybe a T20 game, some aspect of sunlight is involved. Even day-night one-dayers have sunlight involved. Now, maybe that puts the people batting under night conditions in danger, or field, not batters, the fielders in night condition. It just staggers me that we're taking this route with it. And honestly, how much will change when we come back?
Yeah, well, I agree with you, John.
I don't see there being a great change whatsoever.
Look, I think teams are going to be more cleanliness focused than probably they were. And
for
I think
about 2 months.
Yeah. And I think the world have got a little bit complacent. Look, I'm a big believer that I think we need to have kids playing in the dirt and not having helicopter parents going, oh, no, and hand sanitizing their hands straight away, because you build up immunity that way. And I heard a lady on the radio from one of the top universities on the East Coast saying that, you know, the problem is today not so many women breastfeed, and we don't allow our children to build up natural immunity, and that's why we're more susceptible. And she was saying incredibly that if to build up the immunity of people of our age, John, you would have to breastfeed a child now to the age of 5, which I was astounded.
Look, I just don't think that in the long run we will be much different than what we were before coronavirus, I call it. But anyway, people will go back to normality. They'll go back to doing what they always did before. There might be some people that sort of reassess where they are in their lives as far as, you know, what activities they might participate in, what's important to them these days and what's not important. But as day-to-day life, people will just go back to what was happening before. We've already seen it starting here. You know, the government announced several days before restrictions would be cut back that they were going to cut back the restrictions. What happened? People just went out and started treating it as if restrictions had been cut.
Yeah, they jumped the gun.
They definitely jumped the gun. And it's quite obvious that people are just going to go back to normal. I mean, people went back to normal after the Second World War. People went back to normal after the First World War. Some things changed, but not the little things in everyday life.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting because at the moment, and I find myself, if people get too close, you kind of look at them and go, what are you doing? Whereas if it's then suddenly we're going back to watch sport, you know, having grown up standing on the terraces, to me, that's part of the wonders of being at a sporting venue and watching a game, is that closeness with everybody in that you're sharing that passion. You can feel that enjoyment, the excitement and the tension through everybody else being in close proximity. And I think if you're split away, that's going to just kill the whole vibe of actually going to a live game.
It is. And what happens, I know that the sports in this country are deciding to go back. You know, they've announced we're going to be starting again at these dates and all that sort of stuff. One person gets it. One person. And we've seen still in Victoria, you know, they've shut McDonald's. 12 McDonald's stores have shut because one person. We're not through it by a long stretch. But I don't think we should panic about what will be happening once we get through it.
Yeah, I think we'll get through it as individuals. I think there are certainly some sporting clubs, as we've touched on in the last two podcasts, are going to find things very, very difficult. And some sporting bodies as well are going to find it very, very difficult. Now, I hope, though, that I was always told, you know, in everything that's bad, if you can find the positives and then move forward with those, then you'll be in a better place at the end. And I think we've got to see some of these sports trimming the fat in terms of administration. And I think, as we're going to probably touch on after the interview, we've also got to look at the way some of these sports are governed. The boards have got to actually step back and be more governance orientated than actually hands-on.
Well, we've seen in the sport we don't mention here, and they're coming back mode, they're having to slash their coaching staffs. And maybe it'll actually help sport understand that we don't need to be that top heavy. We can have good, tough, top level flight competitions without hundreds of backroom staff.
I agree 100%. I think the problem, though, you've got there, John, because you uncover and then another big thing, that one of the revenue streams that these organisations have is getting coaches qualified. Then, of course, you've got to find jobs for those coaches. And this is one of the problems we've seen, especially in football, where the FFA has encouraged all these people. There's not enough jobs. There's now just too many coaches,
yeah.
And there's not enough jobs. Certainly at the higher end, where all those people that have done their pro licence, you know, there's just not the jobs for them.
Oh, yeah, basically. It's a classic case of what happens at universities. You know, they'll drag as many students in to get an MBA as they possibly can, but there's only so many jobs for people with an MBA.
Yeah, and how many people do you meet in certain walks of life where they've got a degree in something and they're working in a completely different industry unrelated to it?
Yeah, exactly. And they've taken what they've learned from their degree or from their coaching certificate or whatever they have and applied it in a totally different area. Yeah,
absolutely.
What other changes are sports going to be compelled to make or feel compelled to make? I mean, if licking a ball is deemed to be dangerous, where does tackling come in?
Well, yeah, I mean, rugby union and rugby league, you think where you've got no chance.
Yeah, under that sort of guideline, yeah.
Yeah.
How could you possibly
continue?
Because
you can't
continue?
Have a scrum. No. You can't have a ruck.
Even basketball and hockey, all of those sports that, okay, basketball and hockey might nominally be non-contact, inverted commas, but there's plenty of bodily contact in those games all the time. Very few team sports, and I, once again, team sports, should be important to note that, would fit under a criteria that sees people not being allowed to lick a cricket ball.
I do wonder whether, you know, the media have been struggling, some section, and I shouldn't be as general as that, but some of them have really been struggling to try and find something to write about when there's been no sport. And I do wonder whether some of these stories, there's a guy just sitting there going, yeah, what can I think up that'll stir a bit of a reaction? And having worked on that side of the fence, I can tell you many years ago, we ran a story that was completely fictitious, which sent alarm bells around. Well, it used to be a rumor column that we did, and my old boss, Chris, we'd sit down and try and come up with these rumors. Some would be very genuine, and this one we created, but it caused all immense amount of sort of worry, because we said that all aircraft now, if you were going to hire a car when you arrived at a destination, they would breathalyze you before you could take the car. Now, you can imagine there's a lot of people who have quite a few drinks on a plane, get out, businessmen, then go and hire a car, and the car company's going, we're not going to do that because, you know, it'll cause all sorts of problems. But if you think about it,
makes sense.
It's a very realistic thing.
Very clever, that one, actually. I like that.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here. You're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and it's time for our guest on this show. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, skateboarding is under the microscope here, and we're catching up with a young lady who's been commissioned to paint skateboards. And we're going to hear how she got into that and how it's all moving forward. And I think with skateboarding really coming to the fore as a sport in recent times, she is in the right place at the right time. And our guest on this show is Marielle Flood. Marielle Flood, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hi, Ashley. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a slightly different topic to one that we normally cover, but when I heard what you were up to, I was really fascinated and wanted to find more. Now, if we can just start, because I believe you actually were originally a graffiti artist, and maybe you can tell us about what that was like as a young teenager in Perth.
Yes, graffiti was kind of my first interest in art, which began from the 80s movie Style Wars, which kind of covered the early history in New York with breakdancing and graffiti. And I'd always kind of drawn pictures. And after watching that, I felt like that was something I could do and wanted to pursue. There was quite a big scene here in Perth with that, but it's mainly male-dominated, as you can imagine. And as a female, kind of, you had your own little niche, I guess, but I found the scene was quite supportive towards me.
Was it very much an underworld scene at that time?
It is. It's changed quite a lot now, where street art is kind of an offshoot of graffiti, I guess, but it's shunned by the graffiti crew that prefer the, you know, painting in spots that they're not supposed to and keeping to lettering and stuff, whereas the more commercial scene with street art is more painting symbols and happy things to appease councils.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I mean, you don't have to answer this, but did you ever get in trouble for your graffiti or not?
I didn't get in trouble, but I decided to quit while I was ahead, which is why I made the transition into other arts. Now that I'm 38, a few years ago, the last thing that we went to paint was at an abandoned building. And there was a bit of a drama there with my friend's car getting broken into and him trying to, you know, chase the people that he felt were responsible that were in the building and stuff. And after that, I just thought, getting a bit old for this, but it's an art that's kind of in my home because I just want to paint my piece and go. I don't want any of the other drama that often does go along with that.
Now, I mean, you seem to have sort of built a reputation painting skateboards, but before we talk about that, I mean, were you a skateboarder? Were you into any sports?
No, I've never really been into any sport. It was always music was my sort of main love, but I have absolutely zero musical talent. So sort of drawing art on musicians I like and pop culture, movies and things that I like was my way of getting involved without having that actual musical talent.
Right. So I think you said you discovered paint markers around 2015. And I mean, how did it come about that you sort of went painted on your first skateboard?
I kind of collect whatever the new in thing is, I guess, with art materials and stuff. So I've had them for a while, but just drawing on paper and things, still kind of in my graffiti space doing lettering and stuff, it didn't really work because I used to bleed through the paper and that kind of thing. And I've sort of seen with the advent of Instagram and social media, people were painting skateboards, but it was, again, more lettering. And I had started to sort of move away from that. So I thought, I'll just see if I can paint a face with these markers because they should work quite well on wood. And that's how it started.
And, I mean, were you surprised then at how it sort of evolved? Because I believe it was really just exhibiting at Royals Chicken and Burgers in Victoria Park here in Perth that has kind of given you the kickstart that you probably needed in this area.
Definitely, because it was never my intention. As I said, it was just a one board, and I had put that on my Instagram, and from there, like, people were asking, and there was definitely interest. And when Royale's opened, it was only because I Googled to try and find the menu, because I wanted to eat burgers. And I saw that they had done a post saying they were looking for community artists to display on their wall, and if anyone sold stuff, then great. And it was funny because now they're good friends of mine, but originally when I went down, I got what I often get in the beginning, sort of the brush off that, oh, yeah, send some stuff through, but then thinking, you know, that's a girl, what does she know about this kind of urban style art and stuff? But once I'd sent stuff through, they changed their tune quickly. and I just put one board there initially. But they actually had a friend who had bought one of my boards previously, and he had ended up displaying it there for a while, and people kept asking to buy that one as well. So he ended up taking it back. But because they were getting so much interest, they asked me to pop a few more there. So fast forward through the years, now they've got 3 Royale stores, Vic Park, Wembley and Northbridge, and then they've got a Mexican store in Fremantle, as well as Baby Roy's in Melville. So I've got 6 boards in each of the burger stores, and I've just got some display stuff in the Mexican store as well, which is not boards, just some Mexican theme artwork there.
Fantastic. Now, who's buying them? Is it the actual athletes and the skateboarders who, and if they're buying them, are they using them for display, or are they actually boarding on them as well?
I always ask that because obviously if you're particularly wanting a certain image and you're going to skateboard on it, there's the chances are that you're going to wreck it. So there's different boards that I buy. There are the ones that are suitable for skating, and then there are ones that are just recommended for display, and the difference is they're the same size but they're a bit thinner. So always check that out with whoever hits me up for something. They do hold up quite well, people that are boarding on them, and they show you pictures later because, you know, we'll set them with a clear coat and everything. Just depends on your skating ability, really, on how much you wreck it.
I mean, if they are going to skate on them, do you put sort of like a resin over the top to protect your artwork, or is it just up to them to be, as you say there, they've got to be a better skateboarder and not come off and ruin it?
I do clear coat it and like let that sit for a few days and then clear coat it again. I prefer not to, and I always ask if it's just display, I don't, because it tends to bleed the colours a little bit and it can change the look quite a bit. So I always check and let them know that that can be the case.
But are you finding, as I say, going back to that question, are more of them buying them to display, or are they actually, you know, wanting to just show it off on the actual various competitions?
I find that most of them are just for display, and I think it's became a niche because I guess people don't necessarily just want a canvas to hang up or a framed picture, and as well with the boards, it's something quite small. so it's easy to find a space for.
Yeah, one of the questions that actually I told someone I was catching up with you, and they said, can you find out, would it be the skateboarder that influences the art, or is it the art that's actually influenced the skateboarder? So if we look at, you know, if you look, skateboarding many, many years ago was sort of connected to the graffiti culture in that they were, wherever they were boarding, there tended to be graffiti because it was sort of under bridges, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, where is the influence coming from, do you think?
There's definitely cross over. Like, there is a bit of a separation because the skateboarders don't always necessarily come from the hip-hop side of things, though a lot of them do. A lot of them are also quite alternative. But as you say, you know, the ramps and the parks often have graffiti around them, and skateboarders are often involved in that. And as well with hip-hop, a lot of sort of musical artists are into that, and then they cross over into clothing, and then they do vinyl wraps on skateboards, and that kind of thing is quite big as well.
No, it's an interesting world, and I mean, it strikes me that you've got into it at about the right time, because, you know, skateboarding was very big in my teenage years back in the 70s, 80s, and it sort of then dipped away, but it's come right back, and if we look, was meant to be a sport at the Tokyo Olympic Games had they gone ahead this year.
Yes, I mean, I felt like it died off in my younger years, and I don't know if it was just because I wasn't really around that, but the scene certainly exploded in my area. I live right near Mills Park, and that's one of the parks that they redid, and there's always a huge amount of skateboarders there, even though it's supposed to be closed right now. Can't deter them.
You never can. I mean, what artwork do people ask for? Is it, along, as you said, that sort of street art style, or do they want a picture of themselves on their boards, or, you know, their pet dog, or what is it that people are actually looking for, or does it vary immensely?
It's usually musical artists, that's the most of it, but I do get some, like, unusual requests, well, not even unusual, but, you know, I have had the, can you do my pet dog, or can you do me, but generally it's their favourite, yeah, music, sport, other athlete, that kind of thing.
Now, I believe you have actually managed to meet some celebrities through this artwork that you've been doing, and in fact some of the rappers actually own your artwork, is that true?
Yes, that's correct. Some of the rappers are probably names that you're not familiar with, but I did get to meet as well Robert Englund that played Freddy Krueger.
So wow.
I've got a board of his that I'd made with him in the Freddy Krueger character, and he signed that, and he was very complimentary, saying, oh, where did you buy that from? I've never seen anything like that before, and was quite surprised when I said, oh, I've actually painted it. And he was sort of like, oh, I don't want to sign this because I don't want it to get wrecked. But I explained to him that, you know, it's just display to hang up as artwork, and he's quite older, so obviously probably not too involved with the skate world. But yes, beyond that, I've met Method Man and Redman and Slick Rick and Raekwon. Those guys, with the exception of Slick Rick, are from the Wu-Tang Clan. I'm not sure if you're familiar with them.
I am indeed, yes.
90s rap group, so I've got all my stuff hung up together, signed from them. Ja Rule as well, but that was a portrait that I did because that was prior to the sort of skateboard era. He was my favourite rapper as I grew up. And probably my highlight would be Russ. He's a fairly new rapper that's just come up in the last few years. But I drew a portrait of him last year and I went to the concert, and he liked it so much he commissioned me to do one for himself because I wasn't willing to part with it. Wanted to get mine signed while I was there. And I also did a denim jacket for him with his favourite rapper on that he has as well.
Fantastic. Now, I also believe, though, you had a request to paint an Aston Martin, which seems almost an incredible request. And how was that? How did that come about, and what was that to do with?
So, Event Cinemas, I've often done things here and there, you know, live paints, a little bit of graphic design and stuff for them as well. And when they have openings of new movies, where they, you know, give out free for the first session and stuff, they often put events on that go with that. So they got together with the fab car business over here, and what they did was they wrapped clear vinyl over the car, and then they asked me to paint it with a Fast and Furious theme thing on the red carpet at the night. So it was partly to promote the movie, and they also wanted to promote the vinyl that goes over the car, so to say, you can paint it, you can change your look whenever you want, it's not going to damage the paintwork, you just can peel it off once you've had enough, whether that's 1 day or 6 months or whatever. But, yeah, painting an Aston Martin was definitely a new one for me.
So when you were doing that, I mean, The Fast and the Furious is obviously in a cult movie chain. Had you seen the films and therefore you knew what you were going to do? Or did you get a sneak preview to see that movie to inspire you as to what you were going to put on the car?
I had seen up until the series in that point, and we did get to watch the movie afterwards. But this was actually one of my most challenging live paints because I was actually asked to do it that day.
Wow. So,
I didn't have much time at all. I only had a couple of hours and I was at work that day. I had to ask if I could leave early. But it all came together. Sort of we did the logo in the middle and then just, you know, some kind of car themed and characters in the background. And it did get huge engagement because, you know, painting an Aston Martin, people have never seen that before. So there was a lot of questions I had that night.
I'm sure you did. Now, I mean, it seems to me that you've obviously carved a niche in the skateboard world doing that, but I mean, are there opportunities for you to say do snowboards or surfboards, or have you been asked to do any of those, or even sportsmen's helmets? Because, you know, there's enough sport where now we're seeing players wear headgear, for example, ice hockey or field hockey. You know, the goalkeepers are wearing helmets, and Andrew Charter in the Australian team, he actually has his helmet painted with some pretty fancy artwork as well.
I actually do have a helmet here that is all prepped and ready to go, but it challenges me in a design space because of the shape. So you really need to think of how that's going to work. And I've started it a few times and ended up rubbing it back because I'm just not quite happy with it. But that's something I definitely hope to get to. And surfboards would essentially be like a skateboard for me design-wise. So I would really like to do that. But, I mean, blank skateboards are quite easy for me to find. You just go to Jackson's, you pick them up sort of thing. Whereas surfboards, I'm not quite sure where I'd source that kind of thing. But if anyone wants one done, I'd definitely be interested.
How would they get in touch with you? I mean, I know you've got an Instagram account, which is at Marielle150. How else could they reach you?
Most of my custom does come through Royales. People sort of go have a look and see if there's anything they like. Otherwise, yeah, they just reach out to me by Instagram or by my phone. But there's business cards available there with all my details on them.
Okay, because we've got listeners all around the world, so you might get some requests we don't know. We'll have to wait and see and hope that's the case. But, I mean, is there anything that you look ahead and think in the sort of sporting fit sphere, I'd really like to paint that?
I definitely do want to do surfboards. I'm not sure how well that would hold up in water, but I have seen other people on Instagram doing them, so I assume that it works quite well. Again, it will be with the clear coat over the top and stuff. So, yeah, I'm definitely keen. If there are any surfers out there, maybe we can work together.
I mean, the thing is, I think there's a real opening for this because I think these sports fans are getting a bit tired of just advertising on various people's equipment. And I think they want to see this creativity. If you look at it from an athlete's perspective, it really makes them stand out and gives them an extra point of interest. So it seems to me that this is an industry, if dare I call it an industry, but it's an area where certainly there's huge potential for the likes of you. Do you agree with that?
Definitely. I think being able to have something instead of, like you said, advertising or just a plain printed photo or whatever, if they can conjure up something that's a complete one-off that nobody else has, then that gets a lot of interest for them, obviously.
Now, we've plugged, obviously, if people want to get in touch, but let's just stress the fact that you're not there just for professional athletes. You'll do this for anybody, won't you?
Yes. Obviously, I prefer to sort of do my own thing because I feel that's where you get the most authentic art, you know, rather than someone saying this is exactly what I want. But I always work with any requests that they have because I won't just kind of say yes and I accept it. And if they give me a picture that isn't going to work, because my main thing is I want to make sure that I'm happy with the art and I know that they're going to be happy with the concept that they get as well.
Well, Marielle, it's been fantastic catching up with you. Look forward to seeing some of your artwork down the track, and we hope that this is something that just keeps growing for you because I think it's just fantastic.
Great. Thanks for having me, Ashley.
Hi, I'm Zocco Kallitz, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yeah. Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show. And that was Marielle Flood, our special guest on this show. And John, I know how you love your music. And interesting how she was saying how much of an influence the music and the skateboarding have kind of come together, and how the music stars are actually interested in her boards.
Well, I think when you look at the rise of skateboarding culture, it really came out of Southern California in the 90s. I mean, skateboards were popular when we were kids in the 70s, but they sort of died out. And they
Michael J. Fox, come on.
But they really took off in the early 90s, and along the back of the rise of American punk. Let's call it American pop punk.
And very different to English punk, you must say.
A lot different, yes. If you've ever heard Jet Boy, Jet Girl by The Damned, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. They're intrinsically linked. Skateboarding and pop punk, American pop punk, are intrinsically linked. And their rise charts together. And there's been a series on SBS recently called Punk. It's made by the Americans, so it's very heavily concentrated on American punk. And they basically say that skateboarding, you know, saved punk, and punk saved skateboarding in a funny way. Joined them together, and their success is still intrinsically linked. And it's an interesting dynamic. I mean, I know that she's done boards with Tupac and Biggie and all that sort of stuff, and there is a rap element to it, or hip-hop, or whatever you want to call it, but it's predominantly white boy punk, I'll call it. Yeah, white boys aren't the only people that ride skateboards, but the music that is associated with it is very white.
But, I mean, we've both seen some pictures, and we're going to share those pictures actually on the blog post where the podcast is. So if you get this via another term, just go to the website, notthefootyshow.com. And, I mean, they're fantastic bits of artwork.
Oh, yeah. And, look, skateboarding's a fantastic thing to watch, too. I mean, we've got a skate park across the road from me here at the Coolbill Broadcasting Corporation. And some of the things little kids do, and it's not just on skateboards. They've got those scooter things now, you know.
Yep.
They're doing flips and jumps and all sorts of stuff, and I'm looking, you're 10 years old, mate.
I think all I could do was slalom through a load of Coke cans.
Could you do that?
I could do that when I was younger.
I was really good in a straight line downhill.
But for those of you that are interested, if you want Marielle to commission her to do something, you can contact her, as she said, via Instagram is the best bet, at Marielle150. That's MARIELLE. Also, you can go through, if you live in Western Australia, to Royale's Chicken and Burgers in one of their stores, and they'll put you in touch with her. And of course, she did say in that interview that she will also do skateboards, snowboards, and even surfboards. She wants to get into that, but I don't think she's going to part. John, you just focused on her Freddy Krueger signboard.
I have. She sent through some pictures of the Tupac and Biggie boards, and there's a clown board, and there's a Michael Jordan board that look great, but the one that caught my eye was the Freddy Krueger board, and she's had it signed for Marielle. Sleep kills Freddy, Robert Eglund.
I know. I think that would be a prize possession.
Yeah, good. And look, they're good looking boards. I can't say I'm a big into skating person, but you know, you'd certainly, if you were into it, you'd want a board that looked like that. They're great looking boards.
And I should actually mention as well, Marielle does other artwork as well. She's not just limited to the boards, but because we're a sports show, that's what we focused on. She did do the Aston Martin, for the build-up, as we heard in that interview, to the Fast and Furious 8. And that would have been a real challenge, I'm sure.
Oh, it'd be great, too, to sit, kick back in a cinema full of, you know, a couple of hundred people and look up on the screen and there's your work.
This was not, this was outside the cinema.
Oh, was
it wasn't
it?
Actually in the film. Yeah, it was just a promotional thing.
Well, that's all right. Still, people are going to walk past it and look at it and think it's cool.
Absolutely,
You know, that's how a lot of that stuff starts, isn't it? Who it did is. That? Oh, I'll get that girl to do my stuff.
Exactly.
So, should we move on?
Yep, you're next.
See, you're our resident rugby expert here, Ashley. So,
of the two of us.
Of the two of us. What the hell's going on? What is going on with Australian rugby? I mean, we could ask the broader question, what is happening in world rugby, or slightly less broad, what's happening with Sanzar, but our country's gone to pot. What's happening with rugby? It was once one of the top three, easily one of the top three in this country, and now it's sadly declined. It would be about fifth, wouldn't it? Basketball would have risen above it.
Well, I think it's dropped a long, long way. And I think some of it, of course, is, as you touch on, you know, it's close to insolvent. If they hadn't got the money from World Rugby to help bail them out, they would have been in deep trouble. But you touch on it, World. I mean, USA Rugby's gone broke. And again, they've had to be bailed out as well. And they've put in a new governance structure, which they're hoping will get their game back on track. I think my personal view is I think that the game tried to run before it could walk. When it went professional, and we obviously expanded Super Rugby, which was in place before then, I think that they thought, wow, we've got all the money from Mr. Murdoch coming in from Fox, and we're going to be just, this is going to be fantastic. And they were paying the players money that, yes, they could afford, but they couldn't afford continually if things weren't changed or they didn't put the structures in place. And then my personal view is the legacy that they got from hosting the 2003 Rugby World Cup was that they had the money in the bank. And as we've seen this with a lot of sporting organizations, they've got that rainy day fund. But what they do is when the figures don't look too good on the next annual report, they'll borrow a little bit out of there to plug a gap so that the stakeholders think the game's in a better shape than it really is. What I would question, John, is we've had a board of directors who've made decisions, and decisions that have impacted financially incredibly on the sport. So, for example, the axing of the Western Force and also the Israel Folau incident. Now, whether you agree with that or not, they made a decision to pursue this through the courts. They ended up losing that case, and it was at war. It was an out-of-court settlement. But you only make that if you know you're going to lose or it's going to be to your detriment. So they made that decision to go down that path. Now, if you check the statutes of Australian governance, those board members are accountable for those losses because they made the decisions that have then impacted on the organisation losing money. And I would personally like to see them made an example of. Now, and that might sound really, really harsh, but we have too many boards in this country at various levels, be it national level, state level, and even sort of just local level, where people are making decisions totally irresponsible and not realizing that their decision could cost that club, could cost that sport a lot of money, and then they just walk away. And the sport or the club has to carry that burden. So I would like to see more accountability from the boards.
I think as an example of what's wrong, and I'm not blaming the person involved here, it's what happened with David Pocock.
Yeah, having a year off and getting paid.
Well, nothing against David. I mean, he's an individual and he's going to take what they,
You're going to try, envy him. You're going to try and negotiate the best thing for yourself.
Exactly. So this is not about bashing David Pocock at all, but it is about questioning who thought it was a good idea to give a bloke who wasn't going to play for you $1 million. And not only that, a bloke that was by that stage carrying injuries that seriously put a question mark over his ability to play at that level, which has since been borne out.
That goes back to what I'm saying. They made decisions that have been financially, have put Rugby Australia at risk. And therefore, I'm sorry, those people that were involved in that need to be held accountable.
Well, what does that decision say to the other players about, Dave can have $1 million. Go off and have a holiday, mate. It's all right. There's $1 million. Was it done out of fear that he might go, I'm running out of money. I better go and play a game for someone else or what?
I think they were worried that he was going to head over to Europe and maybe play and they might lose him that way.
And deepest respect to the guy because he's a tremendous competitor. He's a great rugby player and from all reports, he's a fabulous bloke.
He's a very nice human being, yeah.
But by that stage of his career, he was on the he'd be on the watch list, if you know what I mean. Like, let's just have a look and see how things go. He copped a lot of battering in his rugby career, and he was obviously carrying injuries that were never going to get better.
He put his body through the ringer. Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
And he deserves all the accolades and credit he could get for doing it. But you do have to question why they thought that was a good decision.
Yeah, look,
they could do that $1 million right now.
Exactly, they could. It just really worries me. And I think they've also got to look at the structure of the game. I've spoken to, because we've live streamed, you know, some of the local rugby, and you talk to people at the clubs and they're saying what frustrates them is they no longer have a voice. And I think we're seeing this so much in sport in Australia that, and you've touched on it even in hockey, that your local clubs get forgotten. And it's the people or the board members that are from the sports state body that then go and vote on national things. And to me, why can't, as we've seen in this period of isolation, it's not that hard to do stuff online. You could give every club in Australia that is registered with a state federation a vote. Why not? Because the thing is, at the moment, I don't think we're getting the right people representing the clubs. And the sport is primarily about the clubs and not about the elite level.
Well, the elite level doesn't exist.
Without the clubs.
Well, exactly. It just doesn't exist. You cannot have a sport that runs from the top down. It doesn't work that way.
Well, where do you get your players from?
Exactly. And where do you get the money from? And that's what hockey's finding out now with the Pro League. Where does the money come from? It comes from us. Guess what? We're not turning up to watch it because we don't give a shit. Because it's not a proper competition that people recognise as being something they want to follow. It's just a few nations warming up for tournaments. And really, the Pro League is just an excuse for nations to run their national teams out. I mean, I'm sure Hockey Australia loves the idea of it also being somehow linked in to being an Olympic qualifier, because that means they can go to the government and say, oh, it's an Olympic qualifier. We need some money. Thank you very much. And it's just a waste of time. It's a waste of energy. And no one is going to be waking up at 3:30 in the morning to watch one-off game from the other side of the world.
But so what you're saying then there, John, again, is it comes back to this governance. And I think that sporting structures, when it comes to governance, are not right, or they've not evolved with the times. And I think we've, to me, the sports that will survive this and come out stronger will be the ones who are sitting down at the moment while there is no sport and going, okay, we've been doing it this way. There must be a better way. There must be a more inclusive way of doing things that will give us a stronger foundation moving forward.
Okay, things like the World Cup and the Euros in whatever sport, or those sorts of events work because they happen once every 4 years or once every 2 years. They're not every week. Okay, look at the things that happen every week and work, and work very successfully. What are they? English Premier League? Works really well. Bundesliga, La Liga, you go, all of those major soccer leagues work. Why? Because 1 week you're at home, the next week you're away, and guess what? Your fans can get to the game.
And also, John, though, to be fair, they have history on their side, that they've been there a long time. There is a rivalry that has built up over time as well. And there's history. And I think people underestimate the history of sport, because there's so much is built on the history, be it one player that came from that club that then went to another club, or just a one victory over a team in a cup game or something like that can just change the history forever.
Pulling it back to rugby for a second, I mean, I think the best thing Australian rugby could do is get out of Sanzar for a start. I think we waste too much time, money and resource on a competition that not many people are that interested in.
I think where they went horribly wrong, and it was funny because I was going back through the blog pieces, and when they announced that they were going up from Super 15, which is when it was five teams in each, you know, I wrote a piece then about how the conference system was not a good idea. And also it was interesting that the rugby competitions in Europe at that time were cutting back. They were coming back, making them smaller because they'd become too big and too cumbersome. And I think that's what Sanzar made a massive miscalculation there. Traveling to Argentina, bringing them in, bringing Japan in, and it just was too much. I think if you're going to do it now moving forward and you wanted to have a competition between Australia and New Zealand, you have to have the Pacific Islands involved in that as well, which is something we've pushed this barrow for over 10 years. And let's not forget, Sanzar promised them that they would be given the opportunity, and they never have.
No. And it's just when you talk, they say, oh, Argentina got to be in the Sanzar groupings. Why doesn't Argentina play a South American similar? Why don't they just play a series in South America? Oh, well, because Argentina is so much better than everybody else. Yeah, but we're in a competition with New Zealand, mate. No one seems to be too worried about that. I mean, so they're effectively the New Zealand of South America. Teams are only going to get better by playing them, the local teams. If we take them out of that and put them in our little pot, those South American teams are not getting access to the level of rugby that they need to be able to expand.
Yeah, you weaken that exactly. pool as well.
And same with Japan. Japan should be playing Hong Kong. It should be playing Singapore. It should be playing countries in that area, China.
And
whoever.
Then have test matches against the national team.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because going back to what I was saying is I think where rugby tried to run before it could walk. So if you look at when the game went professionally, which was in 1995, there was the World Rugby Corporation was trying to sign players and was going to set something up like the Rugby League Super League. And then Murdoch moved in and basically got New Zealand, Australia and South Africa on board. And that was where, but the interesting thing is Sanzar was born within a month of that agreement.
Yeah.
And you just think, now, did you really structure this properly in a month, you know, in 1 month from signing the deal with Rupert Murdoch? I just question that. And I don't think that they did.
I think we've got to be very careful too about when organisations such as Mr. Murdoch's come into your sport, because they're not intrinsically interested in your sport. I mean, they're not Kerry Packer. One of the things that cricket had going for it and rugby league was that Kerry Packer loved both, especially cricket. He loved cricket. So he had a personal stake in what his company was producing and the effect it was having on the sport. Whereas I don't think some of these larger organisations, such as the Murdoch-run companies, does Murdoch have a serious love for rugby union? I don't think he does, but he has a serious love for the money that rugby union generates.
Now, I would agree with you wholeheartedly there, and I think that's a really good point, because Kerry Packer clearly carried the game to another level.
And
he also brought in, because of what he did, he made the players, he rewarded the players,
exactly.
Which to me is a very crucial part of that, was he felt that they were being hard done by and made sure that they got what they deserved.
And he cared about the broadcast. He would ring. He would ring from home and say, oh, what are you saying about that? Now, some people might that is say, too heavy a hand on the product, but it shows he cared and he wanted the best for the sport, not necessarily, of course it had the spin-off that it was going to make his company's money, but he knew that. He didn't really care about that as long as the sport was, anyway.
I can tell you Shane Healy, when he was the head of 6PR here as well, he would listen to the broadcasts, and if you'd done something wrong, you got a phone call straight after we'd gone off air.
Yeah.
So again, I mean, I respect people that keep a tight rein on things like that. I think that's really good because they're striving for perfection, which to me, there's nothing wrong in that.
It's just an interesting dynamic that we live in where, you know, obviously sport has to make money somehow, and, you know, you got to lie in bed with people that you might not necessarily normally find yourself lying with. But that should have alarm bells, and you should be, you know, it's like sign a prenup, mate. Before you lie down with Murdoch, make sure you sign a prenup. Okay?
Yep, a pre-Fox.
A pre-Fox, yeah. And ultimately, Fox doesn't care. They care about content. That's all they care about. They content.
And subscribers.
Both.
Exactly.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is.
See ya. We'll be back next week.